Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Emerging Adults in Therapy, How to Strengthen Your Clinical Competency by Zachary Cohn, PhD, and Juliana Martinez, PhD. Foreword by Jeffrey Jensen Arnett. Narrated by Rachel Perry. Publisher's Note. This audiobook may refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book. This book is intended as a general information resource for professionals practicing in the field of psychotherapy and mental health. It is not a substitute for appropriate training, peer review, and/or clinical supervision. Standards of clinical practice and protocol change over time. No technique or recommendation is guaranteed to be safe or effective in all circumstances. And neither the publisher, the editors, nor the authors can guarantee the complete accuracy, efficacy, or appropriateness of any particular recommendation in every respect. The names and identifying details of any actual patients described in this book have been changed, and their presenting problems have been changed or omitted. Some patient accounts are composites or fictionalized. Any URLs displayed in this book link or refer to websites that existed as of press time. The publisher is not responsible for and should not be deemed to endorse or recommend any website other than its own or any content that it did not create. The author also is not responsible for any third-party material. Foreword. Going off track and finding your way in emerging adulthood. Jeffrey Jensen Arnett. When I first proposed the theory of emerging adulthood in 2000, my main goal was to draw people's attention to how much the age period from 18 to 29 had changed over the past 50 years. I gave it a new name to help distinguish it from the adolescent period that precedes it, or the more established adulthood that follows. Prior to that time, the late teens and early 20s had often been called late adolescence, because many people that age had not yet taken on the traditional responsibilities associated with adult life, and long regarded as defining the transition to adulthood: stable work, marriage, and parenthood. But late adolescence never worked very well, because adolescence has long been bounded by the physical changes of puberty, and for most people, these changes are over by age 18 or 19, and far behind by the mid-20s. Plus, once I began interviewing people in their 20s, I quickly found that they fiercely rejected the label late adolescence. And I think it's a good general rule for developmental psychologists that we should avoid labeling developmental stages with terms that are detested by the people being described. Young adulthood did not, and still does not, work much better as a developmental term for persons ages 18 to 29. The problem with young adulthood is that its meaning is too elastic. It has been applied to people as young as 8 or 9, see any young adult book section, and as old as 35 or 40. Next comes middle age, and no one longs to be middle-aged before age 40. Any life stage term that can be applied to 8-year-olds as well as 39-year-olds is not going to be very useful. So I proposed emerging adulthood to enhance recognition that traditional adult transitions are coming later than ever. And in their place, from age 18 to 29, is a new life stage that is unprecedented. A period of a decade or more when people are no longer children or adolescents, but not yet adults. When they are freer from parental constraints than when they were younger, but have not yet taken on the new constraints that accompany adult roles, like marriage and parenthood. When their main challenge is to try to make their way gradually toward a more or less stable and satisfying adult life, often with some bumps and wrong turns along the way. I interviewed 300 American 18 to 29-year-olds in the course of the 1990s and concluded that there were 5 features that seemed to make this period developmentally distinctive: identity explorations, instability, self-focus, feeling in between adolescence and adulthood, and an optimistic sense that anything is possible, that they can build for themselves the kind of future they envision. Emerging adulthood turned out to be an idea that many people were waiting for. Many had observed, as I had, that ages 18 to 29 had changed vastly from what they had been decades before, and were hungry for a new concept and a new term that would fit their intuitive sense that this is a distinct new life stage. Calling it emerging adulthood resonated with their personal experiences and observations, and gave them a new way of thinking about it. My original emerging adulthood article quickly became widely read, and by now it has been cited nearly 20,000 times, making it one of the most cited articles in psychology in the past 20 years. With many brilliant and energetic colleagues, I developed the Society for the Study of Emerging Adulthood, SSEA, into a thriving international organization. See SSEA.org. Emerging adulthood also received broad public attention thanks to a cover story in the New York Times Sunday Magazine in 2010. nytimes.com/2010/08/22/magazine/22adulthood-t.html. It was the most read article in the magazine that year. As part of the spread of the idea and the new theory, the concept of emerging adulthood has been fruitfully applied to mental health issues by many therapists and researchers. Jesse Viner's Yellow Brick program in suburban Chicago was perhaps the first residential program for emerging adults with serious mental health problems, constructed using the principles of emerging adulthood theory. YellowBrickProgram.com. Daryl Fraes and his colleagues in Portland, Maine, developed the Onward Transitions program with a similarly well-informed developmental focus on emerging adults. OnwardTransitions.com. Although I am a developmental psychologist, not a therapist, I have sought to contribute to these efforts to apply the developmental insights of emerging adulthood to mental health problems, issues, and challenges. The second edition of my book on emerging adulthood includes a chapter on mental health issues, and the advice book for parents of emerging adults that I wrote with Elizabeth Fischel also contains substantial material on mental health. The present book goes much farther than any previous work in exploring and clarifying the clinical and developmental issues that often coincide with and collide in emerging adulthood. The editors and authors have done a wonderful job integrating the clinical and developmental perspectives. The authors cover a wide range of forms and issues that may arise in therapy with emerging adults, from substance abuse to gender identity to internet dating. This book will be an invaluable resource for therapists working with a broad and diverse clientele of emerging adults. A key part of the value of integrating clinical and developmental perspectives is that it enables us to recognize when a presenting problem is unusual and when it is a typical part of development for a person that age. For example, today it is common for young people to stay in their parents' household into their 20s or move back in at least once after moving out. 50 years ago, this may have been viewed as a failure to launch. But today, it is common enough to warrant multiple possible interpretations. It could indicate that these emerging adults are struggling with mental health problems, yes. But it could simply be that they are between jobs, or between the ending of their education and the beginning of a job, or that they have just moved out of a cohabitating situation, or that the family's cultural background includes a value on young people remaining in their parents' household until marriage. What was once abnormal is now often normal and may not be a cause for concern. The chapters are well-informed and research-based, which is welcome and gratifying. There are many unfortunate stereotypes about this generation of emerging adults, that they are lazy, that they seek to avoid adult responsibilities as long as possible, and that they are narcissists who care only for themselves. 30 years of studying this age group have taught me that these stereotypes are both false and destructive. No one ever benefited from being called a lazy narcissist and related aspersions. I have repeatedly found that virtually every person in their 20s earnestly wants to make a good life for themselves and realizes this is a crucial decade for setting that foundation. For young people who are languishing, it may be an indicator not that they are lazy or don't want to grow up, but that they feel disempowered, depressed, or anxious. The chapters in this book help dispel destructive stereotypes and instead provide many insights into why many emerging adults are struggling to make their way in life and are in need of mental health treatment. Many of the chapters in the book provide case studies from therapy. As a person who has long valued qualitative methods in my research, I especially enjoyed and learned from these case studies. I am certain other listeners will learn a great deal from them and will be moved by them. The case studies demonstrate that identity struggles are often what drives emerging adults to seek psychotherapy. Identity struggles are a theme that carries across almost all chapters, varying in focus from ethnicity to gender to sexuality to love and work, and even including the roles of social media and internet dating. This resonates well with what I have found in decades of research with emerging adults, but it may be a surprise for some listeners. Identity formation is a concept that has long been associated mainly with adolescence, going back to Erik Erikson's theory in the mid-20th century. Yet in interviewing emerging adults, their identity issues come out all the time. What should I do with my life? What kind of person do I want to be? How am I like my parents and other family members? And how am I different? What do I value most? And what values do I choose as the guideposts for living my adult life? What kind of work would I most like to do? And is that path available to me? What are the qualities I most want to find in a potential life partner? These are questions that all emerging adults confront, and sometimes an inability to answer them effectively brings emerging adults into the therapeutic setting. They may be depressed, or falling into substance abuse, or suffering from debilitating anxiety. But for some, they are simply wrestling with normative developmental issues and are in need of gentle guidance from a knowledgeable and sympathetic therapist. One of the features that surprised and moved me most in my early interviews with emerging adults was that nearly all of them spoke optimistically about their futures, even when they were confused and unhappy in the present, as many of them were. Nearly all of them believed the future was full of possibilities and that they would eventually get what they wanted out of life. This optimism dismayed me at first because it seemed so out of touch with the reality of their current lives. However, eventually I came to see it as a psychological resource. How will you ever summon the motivation to rise above adversity, frustration, and disappointment, all commonly experienced during the emerging adult years, unless you believe that a bright and happy future is out there for you somewhere? They may not attain everything they dream of, but for nearly all, there is the possibility of a satisfying and enjoyable adult life. When emerging adults seek out therapy, it is sometimes because the light of those possibilities has gone cold. Even the best therapists can't relight it for their emerging adult clients. That is something emerging adults can only do themselves. But therapists can assist emerging adults in making sense of the problems and challenges confronting them, and in offering them a setting where they can generate the confidence to create their own solutions. This book provides a lot of material that will help therapists help emerging adults to reignite the flame of their hopes so that they burn bright again. A preface by Juliana Martinez. When my daughter was a baby, I learned about infant mental leaps, loosely defined as sudden periods of neurological and physical growth, accompanied by extra fussiness, increased nursing, difficulty sleeping, and clinginess. Tracking these leaps became a bit of an obsession. I found an app called The Wonder Weeks, with a calendar that showed when to expect these growth spurts to appear. As promised by the app, after a challenging few days or so, at the end of each leap, Something wonderful happened. My daughter would suddenly be back to her happy self, proudly exhibiting all her newly acquired tricks, smiling, rolling, pointing, babbling, etc. Witnessing this process in my daughter helped me better understand the pains we, and on many occasions those closest to us, experience as we are transitioning into new psychic terrain, as well as the beauty of what awaits on the other side. Becoming an adult, for the most part, is a gradual and elusive process. There is no app or calendar for this transition. Aside from a few socially normative external milestones that are increasingly less applicable to all, that is, moving out of the family home, graduating college, starting a career, getting partnered, becoming a parent, etc., the parameters of this process are largely undefined. Emerging adulthood is, rather, another transitional period in the series of transitions that make up our developmental lifespan. The term emerging adulthood, EA, was coined by Dr. Jeffrey Arnett to describe a distinct developmental period between adolescence and adulthood, typically spanning ages 18 to 29. According to Arnett, EA tends to be characterized by obtaining a broad range of life experiences before taking on enduring and limiting adult experiences. Arnett, however, does not view EA as merely a transition into adulthood. For him, it is a distinct developmental period. Many of the chapters in this book review Arnett's theory in more depth. Major life transitions can be psychologically challenging because they conjure up uncertainty and loss, and we are, by nature, skeptical of what we do not know and apprehensive in letting go of what is familiar, known, or safe. At the same time, transitions, like mental leaps, provide powerful opportunities for growth and revitalization. My appreciation for overcoming transitional periods is why I thoroughly enjoy working with young adults in therapy. It is a stage that can be both playful and poignant, given that many 20-something-year-olds are trying out new identities to see what ultimately fits. A lot of my emerging adult patients are college or graduate students attempting to define themselves in a professional role, experiencing first serious romantic love and/or painful heartbreak, experimenting and understanding their sexuality, and coming to grips with various sorts of traumas, including but not limited to familial, interpersonal, sexual, social oppression, and racial discrimination for the first time. Of course, a lot of this work begins in adolescence, but my practice has shown me that it is really in one's 20s, perhaps due to pubertal hormones settling in and neurological development stabilizing, as well as increased independence. When people are truly ready to examine the interaction of their inner and outer lives, this examination, or therapeutic endeavor, can be at times chaotic and destabilizing, but more often than not, leads to identity consolidation, as well as the opportunity for young people to discover their authentic selves. Here is an account written by Carmen, a Latina cisgender female who started therapy in her mid-20s. Going to therapy has allowed me to identify the triggers and negative repetitive actions that caused me to feel unhappy or stuck. Before therapy, I never asked myself what makes me happy. I always associated happiness to achieving a goal, whether it was sports or an academic achievement or getting my first job out of college. I focused on achieving something and moved on to the next. I started going to therapy because I was unhappy, with my job, my relationships, and myself. I wanted desperately to vent to someone in hopes that they had this formula to fix me somehow. I wanted to deal with my underlying childhood trauma instead of running away from my past by endlessly filling up my time with unfulfilling goals. My first attempt at finding a therapist didn't go very well. We didn't click. It seemed like she was trying to do her job, but there was no connection. I felt as if she was cold and culturally missing any insights to how I felt. I stopped going after a few sessions. I took the win of at least attempting to go as enough and started repeating the same bad habits. A few years later, I wanted to really face my fears. I was able to get a new job, which was a big factor in my unhappiness with my career. But I still felt really bad about myself, so I decided that talking to someone again was worth it. So this time, I wanted a Hispanic woman. I figured maybe someone that was of similar background would be more empathetic and make me feel more at ease. I've encountered sexual trauma, so for me, a male therapist was out of the question. After a month of searching, I found a therapist who looked promising. I was very apprehensive at first, but things worked out, and I've been going consistently for almost 3 years. I've found therapy to be a form of self-reflection. Like many other things, you get as much out of it as you put in, meaning that you have to be honest with the therapist and yourself. Being vulnerable and listening to the patterns they notice and adding a label to negative or triggering behavior to allow me to identify them and hopefully self-correct in the future has been a real journey. It's not a formula to happiness, but a sort of mirror of the present and how the past impacts me today. I'm happier than the day I started. I've learned that being happy is not this linear path. It's filled with ups and downs, and that's okay. Giving myself permission to be okay with the journey and change the self-deprecating habits into positive substitutes is hard. I would never have had the courage to face my past fears without these sessions, and for that, I'm very grateful. Although this is only one person's therapy experience and clearly not representative of everyone, Carmen brings up a few common themes that I have observed repeatedly in my work with young adults, irrespective of their specific DSM-5 diagnosis. There are many more common themes I could address here, but I chose to focus on the points highlighted by the patient account earlier. First is this idea of achievements as a means to happiness. Starting early in childhood, we seem to be rewarded mostly for our concrete accomplishments above and beyond any other aspect of our lives. Naturally, it can be very satisfying to see positive results after putting in hard work, and this can certainly lead to a sense of fulfillment. However, oftentimes we are blindly chasing goals that are prescriptive rather than inherently connected to our values or interests. Particularly for young adults who have just finished traditional schooling and are used to working for a grade to gain admission to exclusive clubs or institutions, the idea that happiness is not tied solely to material success can be difficult to grasp. As Carmen points out, one can be high-achieving and unhappy if other parts of the self, such as traumatized parts that require healing, remain neglected. Second, the right fit between a therapist and patient is crucial for a positive therapeutic experience. Numerous research studies support the notion that the therapeutic alliance is a significant variable in predicting therapy outcomes. Given time and financial constraints, it is unrealistic for everyone to test out or shop around for the right therapist. However, I am a big proponent of listening to one's gut, and if, after a couple of sessions, one does not feel like they can begin to open up and trust the therapist, then I would advise that the search for a better match continue. For many BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, and people of color young adults like Carmen, this is especially true. A lot of my patients seek me out expressly because I identify as Latina. Even though in many cases our backgrounds are not exactly aligned, there is a cultural shorthand that seems to provide a swifter sense of safety and comfort. This has become even more evident for me in the psychotherapy process group I run, specifically for Latina-identified patients. Last, as Carmen explains, you get as much out of it, therapy, as you put in, and it's not a formula to happiness. A lot of young adults, and many people of any age for that matter, enter the therapy space with an idea, or perhaps wish, that the therapist will fix them or tell them what to do, with similar expectations as when one consults a traditional Western medical doctor. The reality is that many therapists act more like guides, creating a judgment-free zone for the mind to wonder and explore. One of my young adult patients described the role of the therapist as a lighthouse, aiding in the navigation process. There are, of course, variations on how this happens, depending on the therapeutic school of thought or style. But there is never a one-size-fits-all formula to this process. The more open, uncensored, and vulnerable you can be in your therapy, the more you will feel seen enough to affect change or acceptance, depending on what's at stake. Countless important themes and variations come up in the work with emerging adults, many having to do with identity and companionship. Erik Erikson famously called the stages of adolescence and young adulthood identity versus role confusion and intimacy versus isolation, respectively. In chapter 2 of this book, Tuber and Tocatli plant an argument of why these stages should be merged, given today's cultural vicissitudes. In this anthology, we do not cover every topic pertinent to this unique developmental period. Instead, we offer a selection of interesting and original ideas that are specifically related to emerging adults, and not often talked about in the existing literature. The authors, many of whom are on the younger side and emerging into their professional careers, are all mental health experts, psychologists or psychiatrists, with diverse personal and professional backgrounds. We, the editors, hope this book will be a useful resource for training and practicing clinicians working with young people, as well as for young adults and their parents who are interested in both the psychological challenges facing young people in today's world and the therapeutic practices that can help them navigate those challenges. A preface by Zachary Kahn. The editors of this book, Drs. Juliana Martinez and Zachary Kahn, met in graduate school. This was 2010, and we were in the same cohort of 12 young people beginning to learn how to be psychologists at the City College Clinical Psychology PhD program in Harlem, New York. At the time, Juliana was 24, and I, Zach, was 26 years old. Being at City, as the program is colloquially called, was revelatory. I remember the feelings of that time well. A giddy excitement at being surrounded by bright, curious people. A palpable sense of nerves, but mostly a feeling of sweet relief. It felt like I'd found my people. Looking back, I am so grateful for both having been able to figure out a way to work that engaged my mind and my spirit, and for having many privileges that afforded my ability to pursue this work. Since I first began seeing patients, I've worked with young adults. I've also worked with children, adolescents, veterans of all ages, and people old enough to be my grandparents. But seeing young adults in therapy continues to be a real passion of mine. Part of what has drawn me to this clinical work is the dichotomy it often represents. Young adulthood is ripe with endless possibilities for all the ways that life can be lived. But at the same time, young adults can feel so overwhelmed by the pressure of making big life choices, leading to stuckness, brittleness, and downfall. Here we have life, when one's identity around work, relationships, art, race, and gender begins to gel and bloom, clashing with the potential for death. Too many young folk feel isolated, incapable of seeing beyond their current station, and prone to making impulsive choices, too often resulting in psychological turmoil, suicide, or even murder. Working with young adults has given me many opportunities to reflect upon that time in my own life. While I didn't realize it then, looking back upon that time now, I can recognize that I was struggling at 19. Back then, I could pass for fine, or even better than that. I had good friends, was doing well enough academically, and had had a winning season as a college athlete. At the same time, I had gained much more than the freshman 15. And after a friend from college took his own life in the winter of my sophomore year, I sank into what I can now recognize as depression. Unfortunately, Jake is not the only young person I've known who's committed suicide. He was the first.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?